We come to the ninth presentation in the 2012 series on Hermetic Bodhisattvas. And what we're taking our time beginning is to ensure for us that the complexities that are going to arise will not baffle us, and that the subtleties, which are the most subtle things that this planet has ever experienced, will not elude us. And so we're keeping ourselves circulating. We're doing something which is, in a geometric way, called spiraling. But in an energy mode, it's chiraling, where we're spiraling in two different directions, clockwise and counterclockwise at the same time, which produces a sense eventually of an equilibrium that refines itself to a zero horizon. And that zero horizon, the best word ever used on the planet for it is Tao. Tao is the complete zero horizon that allows for there to be a single dimension in the universe. And that single dimension is the forward movement of energy. And that forward movement of energy registers in a double chiral way as the ability to have a frequency like a sine wave of energy. That sine wave has troughs and crests, and the troughs and the crests are always symmetrical. And they are symmetrical because there is a central direction that has that zero nature and allows for a spontaneous emergence of the first dimension, which is time. So that time is pure energy. And because it is pure energy with troughs and crests in symmetry, one is able now in the early 21st century, just barely able to understand that materiality does not occur in singles. It always occurs in pairs. In the Tao Te Ching, Lao Tzu says, the Tao that can be named is not the eternal Tao. But the deepest, which can be named, is paredness. And that paredness is the troughs and crests of energy that allow for the paredness of whatever occurs phenomenally to occur in such a way that it can be detected either in the trough or detected in the crest, so that something like an electron does not occur simply as a particle. It occurs in a pair of quantum states, so that in order to understand the quantum states, one has to be able to have the ability to see that when you are measuring in terms of time, it will measure in a particular way. If you measure in terms of space, it will measure differently, so that your result in terms of trying to identify is ultimately going to be uncertain. The uncertainty principle of Werner Heisenberg. Because when the quantum mechanical consciousness began to dawn in the late 1920s, it was impossible to be able to do the math in such a way that you could measure the place in space and the time together accurately. You could do one or the other. Later on, after Heisenberg, came Erwin Schrödinger, who understood that we are going to be trapped if we try to limit ourselves to particality that cannot be measured accurately. So he developed what is called wave mechanics, a sophisticated way in which to refine the ability for mathematics to expand so that it could bring in the totality of the wave of the energy. But when it was successful, it had a very peculiar quality to it, and two geniuses at that time, the late 20s, verging on 1930, introduced enormously sophisticated mathematical techniques and ideas. The first one was Paul Dirac, an Englishman of the highest quality of intelligence and consciousness. And there is such a thing now, if you take a look at one of the latest issues of Nature, the international science magazine for the last 130 years. I'll bring the issue in next week. Dirac space now is confirmable because we have a mathematic that is able to encompass because it abandons the need for identification. It abandons the addiction to phenomenality being the arbiter of existence. The other mathematician was a French nobleman, Prince de Broglie. The de Broglies go back to the French Revolution and before, as one of the great noble families of France. It was de Broglie and his brother conferring with him, who understood that there really is something going on here, that the wave is multiple, and that the way in which it could best be understood is that there is a carrier wave, which is the main wave, that maintains itself because there was a reference wave that tuned it. And as the reference wave tuned the carrier wave, like an anchor that keeps a ship anchored, if you weigh the anchor, then you can sail. But the sailing then has the carrier wave, which has a peculiar quality to it. Later on, it was understood to be a soliton. A soliton is a wave that does not lose its energy, does not diminish. It carries through exactly how it was tuned, how it emerged originally. And then de Broglie, because he was just as excellent as Dirac or Schrödinger or Heisenberg, he said there is a third wave, which is a pilot wave, which keeps the refining going so that the reference wave, carrier wave relationship is constantly keeping its symmetry, and that's how it moves as a soliton without losing itself. What is being presented here, especially the last handful or more years, is that this can be applied to history. Because there was a pioneer, an American genius. His name was Henry Adams. Henry Adams' father was Charles Francis Adams, who was Lincoln's ambassador to England, and took his young son, Henry, with him, so that Henry was raised in the highest diplomatic arenas in the world, on the highest level. But Charles Francis Adams' father was John Quincy Adams, the sixth president of the United States, and his grandfather was John Adams, the second president of the United States, so that Henry Adams had the most distinguished pedigree that Americans could possibly have. He was a fifth generation Adams, and he was a genius at writing. He had a brother named Brooks Adams, and to exercise his historical genius, he wrote a 9-volume history of the administrations of Jefferson and Madison, saying that this was the wheelhouse of the way in which the United States was regenerated, not from colonial times, not from revolutionary times, not from constitutional times, but because it had an expandable, refinable dimension of history. And this gave Henry Adams the clue that there must then be an energy phase to history. And he began to investigate this with all of his genius. And his wife's name was Clover, absolutely delightful, dear, beautiful, excellent woman. And he realized when they were on vacation off the coast of France at Mont Saint-Michel, which is the palace-like monastery that's off the coast so that when the tide comes in, it's an island, and when the tide goes out, it's on a great sandy expanse. And from there, they went to Chartres Cathedral, and he suddenly got it, that these two symmetrical occurrences in history were a high apex of the historical phase, that X marks the spot because both of them, if it were just one or the other, it wouldn't have made a huge impression that the pair of them, the symmetry of them made on him. Mont Saint-Michel was like the wave, and Chartres was like the particle, both occurring, having to be built at great expense over some generations of time. In the case of Chartres, as soon as the original Chartres was built, it burnt down and had to be rebuilt, and was. So that because he was also scientifically educated and alert, he took the phases of matter, starting with gas, moving to liquid, moving to solid, effervescing again. And so he applied the rule of phase to history. And one of the last things that he wrote, Clover had passed away. He had taken a huge apartment in Washington, D.C., was devastated by the First World War and the way in which people were not recognizing that you have to know where you are in history in order to be able to refine your persons and to refine the way in which mankind governs itself. If you don't know where you are and when you are, you're guessing, and the guesses are getting worse and worse. In the rule of phase applied to history, Henry Adams came to understand that there is such a thing as the energy running out, that the energy that carried history has an ending. It has a place where it literally runs down to zero. And he computed and published. His brother, Brooks Adams, was the one who made the publishing arrangements. Adams, by that time, was devastated at what he had come to understand, that history ends in the 21st century. History ends in the 2020 time period, and that there is nothing that anyone can do, because this is understandable, computable. What has come into play here since then, and bringing in the quantum mechanics, bringing in Einstein and relativity, bringing in a number of other refinements, is that what ends is a time form, not history. That time forms have a limited cycle. The largest time forms are rather large. They're about 2,000 year time form periods. In ancient Greek, it was called an aeon. The Latins just simply went for an age. For the Latin-speaking Romans, they were very proud of Rome's history, but it was founded in 753 BC. For them, they didn't use BC, but they realized we have to have smaller increments of time forms, otherwise we get swallowed up. So they went for ages that lasted for a period when that age, when it was over, a succeeding age would come. And for them, there were four ages. There was an age of gold, and when it ran out, then there was a silver age. And when it ran out, there was a bronze age. And when that ran out, the fourth age was an age of iron, where everything is very difficult. But the difficulties engender a return to the gold, next golden age. Then it happens like that. The Greek word, popularized again by Carl Jung in the middle of the 20th century, is enantiodromia. It means a complete, total return, which reverses instantly an iron age at its end into a new age of gold. And for them, they were able to compute, being good Caesar obedient Romans, that the new golden age always had a prophet, and that the prophet for telling about the golden age was chosen by Augustus Caesar, and that was the world great Roman poet Virgil, who wrote the Aeneid, of course, and several other classics. In one of the other classics, he wrote very sophisticated spirit person poems, hymns, that were very much like prophetic writings which were so damaging to the Roman hierarchy that they collected all of the Chaldean oracles and these kinds of prophetic things, and it was a capital crime to withhold them. They were collected, they were destroyed, they were stored in Rome, in the Forum, and the eclogues of Virgil, in the fourth eclogue, it's called the Messianic Eclogue, he predicts that the age of gold is about to occur because time, as a woman in travail, is going to give birth to a divine child who will usher in the new golden age. That eclogue was written just before he died in 19 BC. And in order to take advantage of this prophetic wind, Augustus Caesar decided to permanently record this as the construction of a new age trigger. And that when that new age trigger would be finished, that is what will occur. And all the power that there was in most of the world, the entire Mediterranean world, all the way stretching through into Persia, into the British Isles, went into him constructing the Temple of Eternal Peace. It's called the Ara Pacis Augusti, the Temple of Augustus's peace. And at that time, it became Rome, the Eternal City. And he began it in 13 BC, and he finished it in 9 BC. So that there was this age-old realization that there are time forms that have to do with the cycles of world history, and that there always is a couple of human beings who understand this, and in particular, some one human being who has the power of the time forms. And when he finished the Ara Pacis Augusti in 9 BC, he placed it where the Via Flaminia comes in from northern Italy. In Latin, Flamen is a high priest. So it's the way, the road, like the Appian way, this is the Flaminia way, the high priest way, that comes from the great northern Italian areas and cities. In particular, from that area around Mantua, where Virgil was born, where he came from. And in order to sacralize this, the Ara Pacis Augusti was placed on one side of the Via Flaminia, and on the other, Augustus had them begin building his great mausoleum. So that when you come into Rome from the wealthy north, the powerful north, the ancient Etruscan north, into Rome, you pass between these two monumental buildings that form a gate of power that makes the new age Roman. And because Rome now is the eternal city, because it has grabbed hold of the power of history, no one will ever be able to undo that because it has been done permanently right our way. In 9 BC, Jesus was born, not in Rome, but in Bethlehem. And one of Augustus's henchmen, Herod the Great, when he found out that there had been indeed an accurate computation of a child being born, ushering in a new time form age, but that it was not going to be through Augustus or a Roman, but it had happened in a little town near Jerusalem, Bethlehem, and he found this out from three magi, three studiers of the constellations of stars, not by astrology, by the zodiac, but by the way in which the universe patterns itself so that one can learn to navigate. One can navigate by the stars in crossing great waters or in crossing great land masses, but it's the constellations of the stars, not just the zodiac, which has the path of the sun and the moon both going at the same time, but that there's a refinement of understanding what that carrier wave of the sun and that reference wave of the moon, that they are refinable so that one can, with more and more sophisticated pilot waves, be able to understand how even the energies of the sun and the moon and the zodiacal constellations can be refined by enlarging the constellation field that one is dealing with. And that when you do, you begin to get other geometries that were not seeable before. They were there, but they were not seeable before. One of the most striking of them is that in the zodiac, you do not include the great constellation Orion. And one of the biggest stars in our galactical neighborhood is the bright yellow giant Betelgeuse, which is the Arabic name for it. And Betelgeuse is, as we've said, so large that where our sun is, its surface would be at the orbit of Mars. If you can imagine a star that big. It forms with the Egyptian star Sothis, which we know as Sirius, which is a blue-white giant, and was always the ancient Egyptian sign that the renewal of the Nile, giving Egypt its water and its silt and everything, when Sirius came above the horizon, that was the sign. Sirius, Betelgeuse, and a third star. Sirius was called popularly the dog star. And so Procyon is Procyon, before the dog. And it's a huge, bright star. But those three stars make a perfect equilateral triangle. And when you're able to see stellar constellations of geometry like this, you're able to refine the zodiacal frequency so that now you begin to see the larger prismatic ways. And those magi that came in 9 BC understood that they were arriving at the new carrier wave. And they knew this because they had, for the past 500 years, been refining at a Renaissance rate the understanding of how one can not only have a consciousness, but that that consciousness has a different source other than and different from the source of energy and the source of materiality, the zero horizon of nature, that one can have an infinite field, and that the conscious dimensions do not depend upon time so much, but are able, because of their infinite field, unlimited energy of transform and refinement, able to make, instead of there being just another cycle of ages, to cause it to go into a double chiral spiral. And when you get the double chiral spiral and someone holds that double chiral spiral, you get the hermetic caduceus. That when you hold this up, this brings the infinite field of consciousness into transformational play. And when it does so, the time forms now, instead of just repeating in cycles, they double spiral and they increase in strength and energy, so that what begins to lose are those who rule by power which is simply cyclic and repetitive. And that increasingly their power is leached away by the increasing accuracy of the pilot wave people, by the increasing oomph of the carrier wave, and by the reference waves being able to refine further and further, so that we can speak of it simply in this way. We've had four carrier waves. The first carrier wave was the ability to have a written language. The second carrier wave was the ability to have an alphabetical written language. The third carrier wave is that one is able to write in a prismatic, poetic, so that you have the ability to see multiple meanings at the same time. And the fourth, in our time, is that you are able to take a written, alphabetical, multidimensional written language and digitize it. And when you can do that, you now have opened up the ability for a language which has a reference wave. Our reference wave is about 350 years ago, about 1650, 1630, about the time of Sir Isaac Newton becoming mature enough to be able to do his first investigations in optics. And the first one, of course, he closed himself into a dark room with just a slat of sunlight coming through, and he put a pyramidal prism where the sunlight came in, and it spectrum the rainbow on the far wall. And he understood that sunlight can be fractionated into its colors. And in doing so, it means that there's a geometry, not just of colors, but of sub-frequencies to light. And if light can have sub-frequencies, it also can have higher frequencies. In other words, he understood enough about music that there's not only a tone, but there are undertones and there are overtones, so that one is able now to compose very sophisticatedly. And Newton's optics were not finally finished until about 1710. He spent more than 40 years on it. In the meantime, Principia Mathematica established that there is a way to compute, to calculate the infinitesimal energy and space between 0 and 1, or between 1 going back to 0, and that the double infinitesimal calculus gives us the ability to finally develop a more and more and more sophisticated, energized mathematic of language, so that in the digital age of 2012, we are now able to compute a trillion bytes per second. That level is called an attabyte. The first transistor was 1947. It was about the size of a thumb. your new iPad has an ability that was not even conceivable 10 years ago. What is being presented here is that there is a sophistication of time forms now that dwarfs the Roman Empire. It shrinks it to the level of a blithering idiot. Let's take a break. Let's come back to we are expanding and deepening and refining ourselves in such a way that what began really in the 1890s, by the time of the late 1920s, you had something approaching 30 years. From the late 1920s to the late 1950s is another 30 years and gives us almost a 60-year cycle period, which is a couple of generations. If we compute like Jefferson, a generation was at least minimally 19 years. You have three generations in a 60-year period. 60 as a sexagennial form is the way in which the Chinese computed time in terms of a cycle of return, which was based on the I Ching, on refinement over many, many centuries. The original trigrams, the Ba Gua of the I Ching, the basis, was about 3000 BC, about the time of First Dynasty Egypt, about the time of the Irish building New Grange in the Boyne River Valley, about the time of the Mahabharata in northern India at the field of Kurukshetra, not far from where Delhi is today, 3000 BC. And 2000 years later, the original trigrams and their pairing in a symmetry as hexagrams became refined again as if there were another carrier wave operating, but this time it was the millennial splitting of an aeon carrier wave. So that in the middle, the pivot, the fulcrum of a time form is also propitious, as the Chinese would say, for being able to refine your computing. And if you go by the metronome of millennia and realize that a pair of millennia will make that time form of the aeon, a millennial time form will also then have a symmetrical pairing in terms of the time form energy. And that splitting of a millennium into two, a symmetric pair of 500 year cycles, classically, was called the cycle of the phoenix. If you look at the energy of time in terms of time forms, the beginning of it is the trough that reaches its nadir and then curves for the second 500-year period back up to the horizon, the zero horizon of the energy, and then goes into its crest for about 500 years and reaches the apex of that crest and then comes back to the horizon to establish a character wave oomph. We call the apex of the crest of that last 500-year period, we call those now, for a long time, renaissances. 500 years before 1991 AD is 1491 AD, the discovery of America, 1492. The first Gulf War, 1992. You begin to get that you can compute back in terms of the large 2,000-year time form that 500 years before a new carrier wave comes a Renaissance crest. And if that is so, the 0 BC time form had a crest about 500 BC. And when you look at 500 BC, all of a sudden, you don't have a marquee space big enough for the geniuses that were all there at the same time. You had the historical Buddha, you had Pythagoras, you had Lao Tzu, you had the revival of Zarathustra as Zoroaster under Cyrus the Great. You had Ezekiel. I mean, it's all clustered together. Someone like Parmenides. It's like a who's who. And that Renaissance at that time prepared a 500-year return back to the new carrier wave so that you saw that generation by generation from 500 BC to 0 BC, there is an increase in the capacity to be conscious of being conscious. When the historical Buddha died in about 480 BC. Pythagoras had died at age 99 in 471 BC, and Socrates was born and was tutored from being just a smart fellow to being a ingenious world refining teacher, because he was tutored by a woman. And Diotima of Mantinea was of that great generation, of the last generation to have seen Pythagoras and heard him and received teachings in person. And she was able to pass on to Socrates the, not the intangibles of Pythagoras so much, but the unspoken transmission of the new quality of ratioing mathematics, of musicking the ability to look at structure, and the development of the ability to run a tone into half of it, a third of it, a fourth of it, a fifth of it, and on to a tenth of it, so that you have the beginnings of a decimal system of numbers for the first time, but you also have the beginnings of the understanding of proportion ratios, that there is such a way to write one as saying 1/2 + 1/2, or 1/3, 1/3, 1/3. These are ways to write integral, oneness, singularity, but there is also then the understanding that there are powers of numbers, and that When you go to 10, you're not writing in single digits anymore, but in paired digits. 10 is 1 and 0. So that 10 now is powers of 10. And that this frees you from clutching at the identification, at the crippling limitation of using cardinality as the only way in which one can do a mathematic. Now you can do it where you have powers. You can have not just 2, but you can have 2 squared. You can have 2 cubed. That they will bear relationalities together that will establish oneness, that the way in which squares and cubes of numbers have a way of being able to express on higher orders exactly what oneness is all about in terms of its meaning, its expressibility. So that Pythagoras had used a Greek letter, lambda, which is like an inverted V, and that you can put at the apex of the lambda 1, and then you can run down one side the squares and the other side the cubes. And when you come to 2, you can square it and make it 4. You can square that. You can make it 16. You can square that, and so forth, 256. If you cube and run down the other way, you run from 3 squared, 9, 3 cubed, 27, so that you begin to see that the relationship between squares and cubes have what everyone is like calling magic numbers. They are magic because the ratios, no matter how large they get, will always ratio out to oneness. We learned a couple of hundred years ago, it's called Bode's Law, B-O-D-E, that planets gravitationally have their orbits stable around our sun, our star, because the squares and cubes of distance and orbital time equal the oneness of an equilibrium. And that has been refined many times over since then. One of the great translators of Newton, his Principia into French, was Madame du Châtelet, the great love of Voltaire's life. They lived together for almost 20 years in her estate, which is a bicycle ride away from where CERN is in Geneva. She was the one who could understand Newton well enough to translate him into French accurately, so that one began to have in that first generation that were able to read Newton in her French translation produced a bevy of French mathematical geniuses. She was the spirit mother of a whole group of mathematicians. One of them, Lagrange, was the one who refined that not only are there places of equipoise in the orbit of a planet around the star, but anything that orbits then with the sun and the planet, or the sun, the planet, the moon, will have 5 Lagrange points where you will have equilibrium, and that point of no point in space will carry along with the way in which the orbital repose is, and you can have something like the James Webb Space Telescope almost 1,000,000 miles out at a Lagrange point before the moon vis-a-vis the earth, vis-a-vis the sun, where it will stay where it's put permanently. It could be there as long as the universe lasts and never waver and be stable, more stable than any kind of a phenomenal place that you could put such a sophisticated telescope, because it will be universally stable. And also, it will be able to have a conscious array when it's positioned in late 2015. It will be scores of times more powerful and accurate than the Hubble telescope. It will be truly unbelievable and usable without any expenditure of fuel to keep it balanced, gyroscoped. It will have the stability to be able to look almost to that kind of originating edge of the plasma clearing by the first stars to produce something that we simply call space now. But that space, because it was plasma for about 300,000 years, is actually the dark matter. Space itself is the dark matter, and time itself is the dark energy. And in order to express that, one has to keep refining in this way. When he was about 40, Plato, who had studied under Socrates, so that Diotima of Mantinea is the spirit grandmother of Plato. He was told in southern Italy from the Pythagoreans alive at that time, in order for you to understand Pythagoras, you have to literally, as the American Indians would say, walk in his moccasins for a while. You have to be able to take yourself and go to Egypt and put yourself through his refining. And then when you are full enough of that refining quality so that you feel at home with it, then you go to Athens and establish a school. But not a Pythagorean school, but a Plato school, because you're going to be refining at least three, maybe four generations later. And you will pass on then the refinement. And of course, his prize student was Aristotle, whose prize student was Alexander the Great, so that you get, with just a handful of generations, 500 BC, Alexander was born in 356 BC, you get a new reference wave that comes from the Renaissance phase of the previous carrier wave. So that you begin to get a very complex ratioing going on, to write it on a blackboard with chalk, to be really specific, would take an awful lot to do. Fortunately, the math for it was developed in the late 1940s by Richard Feynman, who got impatient with people that couldn't read the mathematics that was coming out because it was so complex. And in fact, in quantum electrodynamics, the actual math kept producing over and over again infinities. It was there on the blackboard. And no one then was sophisticated enough to understand that that's the right answer. The right answer is full of infinities. So Feynman went into doing little squiggly diagrams. They're called Feynman diagrams now, which was much easier to teach people that this is what comes in, it does this for a while, and this is what comes out. Well, what is that? Well, let's run the experiments and let's see. When you put these squiggles together, and you let them stir, and then these squiggles come out. No one realized at that time, the late 40s, the early 1950s, that this is exactly what proteinomics is working on now, because proteins are full of squiggles. They don't have straight line geometries. They have squiggle swirls. And those squiggles, 16, 1,000 of that protein molecule, and then this protein molecule, and those protein molecules, and they all come together and they do their squiggle boogie. And that's how living forms, using a simple alphabet of amino acids, is able to produce unlimited refined proteins that now can be understood by this time in the 21st century and will not only have a genome of the double helix, we will have a proteinome of understanding this is how the nourishment of life occurs. And with our squiggle ability to recognize huge complexities, that the infinities will not bother us at all. We're mature enough to work them in, because the digitization of language, the mathematic, teaches us that the zero is a part of what is real. And the one and the zero together deliver the true energy symmetry that becomes then, through time, blossomed into space, phenomenality, and now we can understand that you don't have to compute with numbers that are single cardinal or even in powers, that one can use instead of a bit, one can use a qubit, a quantum bit, because there's always a symmetry. Even in the zero horizon that's not at this particular moment in this style of computing, there, it's not there in the universe, but it occurs in the cosmos. And so we're learning to be at home in the cosmos, that the universe is a very interesting kindergarten, but that the cosmos is a beautiful postgraduate gift. When I began the study of electrical engineering at the University of Wisconsin in 1958, I went early in the summer. I was 17. To pass language exams, the chemistry exam. I'd had a great high school education. My chemistry teacher was an old ex-retired University of Michigan professor, head of the department, so I was able to ace the university chemistry exam and the Latin exam and so forth. It freed me up, and this issue of the Chicago Review was current in the summer of 1958. It has a selection from Samuel Beckett. It has a selection from Jack Kerouac's The Dharma Bombs. It has Alan Watts' beautiful little thing, Beat Zen, Square Zen, and Zen. And it has an excerpt from D.T. Suzuki, Rinzai on Zen. And it's interesting because here, at the University of Chicago at this time, it was on a par with any place in the world for excellence of scientific understanding. It's because of the University of Chicago, which was never made to be just a nice little school to go to. It was designed from the beginning to be on a level of the highest universities in the world, and so it came to be like San Francisco. It was never really a fishing village. It was made to be San Francisco. The University of Chicago was made to compete with the Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, which was made in 1876 to be on a par with Oxford and Cambridge and all the great continental universities. The University of Chicago was made to be one better than Johns Hopkins or Oxford or Cambridge or any of the continental places. And because at that time, when it was being first made, Chicago was, as Carl Sandburg wrote, the city of big shoulders. A port like New York deals with the Atlantic Ocean, and sure, there is a lot of traffic coming into it, all by ships from everywhere. Chicago's in the center of the continent, and every railroad in the world, in North America, went to Chicago. The Chicago freight yards were, and still are, unbelievably enormous. Unbelievably. So that in order to build really good freeways, they had to have a huge elevated freeway. It's called the Calumet Skyway, that is raised like some super huge aqueduct. And it runs from Gary, Indiana, all the way into the center of Chicago, into what's called the Loop. And it's all over hundreds and hundreds of railroad tracks, so that you get the sense that Chicago is literally the economic and transportational center of North America, not just the United States, but the entire continent. D.T. Suzuki is a case of incredible genius at the right place at the right time. In order to exercise its muscle in the world, Chicago decided in the early 1890s to host a World Parliament of Religion. It was held in 1893, and invitations went out to the entire planet for every religion that had some kind of sizable population to send to Chicago for the World Parliament of Religions. I will next week bring the big green original volume published about that. The Zen Buddhist from Japan was from Engakuji in Kyoto, the abbot and the Zen master there. And it was a new Zen master. The old one had died, just Kitaro had died a few years before. And the successor was Soyen Shaku. And this is the volume published in Chicago by the Open Court Publishing House with Soyen Shaku, who then was so successful because his Zen speeches in Japanese were translated by the young D.T. Suzuki into impeccable English so that they could be read out in English in the World Parliament of Religions. And invitations came from every country for him to travel there. And D.T. Suzuki was there because his Zen master, Soyen Shaku, said, "You've been invited to go to Chicago to translate Chinese and Japanese classics, because you know Chinese, you know Japanese, and you've learned English since you were a little boy. And you're perfectly trilingual, but you cannot go to Chicago until you have your satori in Zen." Satori is the timeless moment that occurs in the zero field. If you're not able to portal reality, which doesn't really have time. Only the universe has time. And you have more complex time than just the universe. But you also have what is seemingly rare. You have the ability to be timeless. And in that timeless moment, that Satori, you will be permanently freed from delusion. Because delusion, in order to gain its substrate, has to have illusion. And if you evaporate the delusive ongoingness, illusion is just a matter of clearing your vision so that you no longer, you can see the illusion, but you're no longer at the effect of it. You can see through it. And it's not that the illusion is gone, but that it's transparent. Because only delusion, like scuffing clouds and fog and dust, keeps you from seeing through illusion. And he said, you have your steamship ticket for next week. You not only cannot go if you do not have your Satori, but you must kill yourself. Hari Kari. So he sat in the Zendo constantly in Ingakuji, constantly, struggling, tussling, and the last night, about an hour to go, he realized he wasn't going to make it. And as soon as he realized he wasn't going to make it, he did. And he wrote, he lived to be almost 97, he said, when I came out of the Zendo, I was shocked because all the trees were transparent. And he said, I looked down and I was transparent too. So he went to Chicago, and the first thing that he translated there was the Tao Te Ching of Lao Tzu. The second thing was the Awakening of Faith in the Mahayana by Asvaghosha. And he went on from there. He married at age 41 this beautiful English woman, Beatrice Erskine Lane. She became Beatrice Lane Suzuki. And this is her cat, Akka, and her kimono. And they found a kind of what we call now shared presence. And they began publishing in 1921 The Eastern Buddhist, which became one of the great magazines of the 20th century. They were the joint editors of it. And it went on until the mid-1960s, and then they brought out the new series of The Eastern Buddhists. And within a year or two, by 1967, Suzuki had passed away just short of his 97th birthday. This is in memoriam of Daisetsu Tetaro Suzuki. He was born Tetaro Suzuki, but after a couple of years of marriage to Beatrice, he earned the name Daisetsu, which means great humility. And one of the qualities of D.T. Suzuki later in life was his ability to ignore delusion and illusion as if it were rain off a duck's back. He was interviewed in 1952, and the interviewer was a young Houston Smith who, in jodhpur-like pants and camp military shirt. He was the big honcho philosopher at MIT, Massachusetts of Technology. And he had this stick that they use in certain Zen Buddhist monasteries, that when you're meditating and you start to fall asleep, they whack you. And he said, well, Dr. Suzuki, slapping his hand and looking cheerful, what is all this about? And Suzuki looked up in such a way that his glasses showed the Klieg lights behind them. And from lighted circles, he said, well, that concerns consciousness. It is a quality, after reading through at 17, something like this, I began to see if there were any paperbacks. And I found this paperback, an Anchor paperback from 1956. It was out for a couple of years, of selected essays by T.T. Suzuki. And these are things that I bought when I was 17. And began to wean myself away from electrical engineering such that I was not interested in even taking mining and metallurgy courses. The thermionic emissivity of molten metals didn't concern me any longer. And it was an interesting thing because I became less and less delusive also about the courses that were being offered. The ethics course in philosophy was so confused that I got a D in it because I didn't believe that they were even dealing with anything ethical at all. When I was told that I was not fulfilling my capacities, they showed me my IQ and they said, you're just wasting your time. You must sit out a semester. And I did. And spent it being the head porter at Sequoia National Park. And when I came back, I had my own money. I was no longer in electrical engineering. I was in a double major with a minor, philosophy, political science, and history. And went on from there. It took about 5 years to graduate, but did well enough that when I took the graduate record exam in 1965, I placed in the 97th percentile. They not only let me into graduate school, but they paid me to go as a prize teaching assistant. All of this kind of cascade of expansion is based upon being able to be at home among the zeros as well as the ones, being able to proportion learning so that more and more excellent jewel cutter facets appear, and as they do, the scintillation factor increases, and you get rainbows within rainbows within rainbows. A computer color chart now will have millions of colors. More next week.